My name is Bob Pinzardi, and I am Vice Chairman of the Middle East Forum's Board of Governors. And before introducing our distinguished speaker, Kenneth Timmerman, I would like to take a moment to tell you about the Forum's important work and encourage you to join in our efforts. Under the direction of Daniel Pipes, one of the world's foremost scholars and analysts of the Middle East and Islam, the Forum consistently displays an unparalleled grasp of issues such as militant Islam. To quote Charles Krauthammer, during the decades when America slept, Pipes was among the very first to understand the dangers of Islamic radicalism. In his many writings, he identified it, explained its roots, and warned of its plans to infiltrate and make war on the United States itself. And to quote the Boston Globe, had the world heeded Pipes' warning, September 11, 2001 would never have happened. Through research, publishing, media work, and public education, including tonight's program, Daniel and his staff have energized the public debate by addressing a range of issues that others neglect and energizing issues by bringing fresh and sound perspectives on policy. My involvement in the Forum's efforts includes this lecture series, where I strongly believe that the Middle East Forum promotes American interests in the Middle East in as sincere and genuine a way as I've ever encountered. I further believe that all of you in attendance this evening will find, if you have not already done so, that the Forum's message is worthy of your enthusiastic support. Your support will further the Forum's efforts to have an impact on public policy and enhance public understanding of this tumultuous region. Literature detailing how you might sign up to receive writings and other materials on how to join our efforts are available at the registration desk. An online archive and membership information is also readily available at the Forum's website, which is www.meforum.org, and you can also access www.danielpipes.org. Before I introduce the evening speaker, Kenneth Timmerman, I would like to ask you to turn off your pagers and cell phones. We are pleased to have C-SPAN filming this event tonight. Daniel Pipes is with us this evening, and he will moderate the question and answer session. Mr. Timmerman will speak for approximately 20-25 minutes, and then we will open this up for questions. In Preachers of Hate, Mr. Timmerman uncovers an ancient hatred that threatens the life and livelihood of every American. The new anti-Semitism targets not only Jews, but Americans specifically and the West in general. It targets our values, our lifestyle, and our freedoms. It is the single most important issue we face when trying to make sense of the Arab world. Most Americans will be stunned to discover the depth and extent of anti-Semitic hatred in today's Middle East and Europe, and many Muslim leaders are not just encouraging it, but spending a great deal of money to spread the lies that spawned the terrorists responsible for the September 11th attack on America. As the United States government asserts its role in the Middle East, Preachers of Hate offers vital information and reframes a very complicated issue as a matter of life and death. An investigative reporter, Mr. Timmerman, has long experience writing for Time, Newsweek, The Wall Street Journal, Insight Magazine, and Reader's Digest. His books include the best-selling Shakedown, Exposing the Real Jesse Jackson, and his latest, The French Betrayal of America, which is available as is the Preachers of Hate for purchase this evening. Mr. Timmerman helped establish the Foundation for Democracy in Iran in 1966, which helps keep Congress and the public informed of the ongoing repression and support for terrorism by Iran's leadership. Since 1987, Mr. Timmerman has operated Middle East Data Project, Inc., a business that provides investigative support and policy guidance to government agencies and private companies on three continents. Tonight, we are pleased to welcome Kenneth Timmerman, who will discuss Preachers of Hate, Islam, and the War on America. Mr. Timmerman?
I've just got to give one quick correction to that. I thank you for the very nice introduction, but it was not 1966. I'm not yet that old. I started the Foundation for Democracy in Iran in 1996 with, among our board members, a moderate dissident Iranian Ayatollah, Mehdi Rouhani, and an individual, Peter Rodman, who is now an Assistant Secretary of Defense. A bit on sabbatical, if you wish. I'm going to try to do two things tonight that might appear unrelated. I'm going to talk about Islam and the war on America, and I'm going to talk about France and its war on America. As you can see already, there's a little bit in common. Nuance gets a bad rap these days. Some people say it's just plain confusion, but I lived 18 years in France and I learned how to speak nuance. The French, in all their great wisdom, have an annual celebration of nuance. It's called Farmer's Day. The real common thread between the two latest books that I've done and I'm going to talk about tonight, Islam and the War on America, Preachers of Hate, and The French Betrayal of America, the real common thread is a sort of reporter's journey through the Middle East, through Europe, and meeting the Preachers of Hate and meeting the Ayatollahs of intolerance, whether they be in France or in throughout the Middle East. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself. I started my reporting career in 1982 in Lebanon. I went there as a young man to report on the war. I was promptly taken hostage by the PLO, kept for 24 days in an underground cell. It taught me something about freedom. It taught me something about America. And it taught me a great deal about the Middle East. It did not teach me, however, to hate or even to dislike my captors. I learned a great fascination. And we had one prison guard whose home downtown in Jordan I've gone back to many times. He came from Karak. After that, I spent a number of years reporting on the Middle Eastern wars in Lebanon, going back and forth from Paris to the Middle East. And I decided in February of 1984, it was my last trip to Beirut, and I realized it was time to head to get out of Dodge when the crazies came in and shot up the booze in the Commodore Hotel. Shortly after that, my good friend Terry Anderson, who had actually reported on my own stint as a hostage in 1982, was himself taken hostage by Islamic radicals in Beirut, and he spent many, many years of a cavalry in their hands. In 1993, I came back to the United States. I briefly worked on the Hill, and then I worked, went to work for a number of news organizations. I've been working for different media in the 1980s, covering the Iran-Iraq War. I went to work for Time Magazine in 1994, and was promptly fired. I think I have the distinction of being one of the few journalists who was fired by Time Magazine. Now, I learned later exactly how it happened, but I'll tell you quickly the story. I had uncovered that U.S. government plants, subsidized defense factories were being sold off to the communist Chinese. And I thought this was big story in 1994. And I went out to Columbus, Ohio to a B-1 bomber plant, talked to U.S. customs officials, talked to union officials, talked to all kinds of people who were outraged that communist Chinese government officials were coming to our highly classified defense facilities. And I brought this back in time to be very excited about it. We had a big four-page story on it, and I went to a number of other factories and discovered several examples of this. And then lo and behold, on Friday afternoon, just before the piece was supposed to be finished up, somebody at Time Magazine, in fact, it was the senior editor in New York, got a call from an individual in the Hunter administration. 2 hours later, I was fired. The story was canned. Time never wrote a word about it until 5 years later, the very companies that I was writing about and that I had been prepared to expose were not just indicted, but convicted in U.S. courts under the same Clinton administration for violating U.S. security laws and export controls. In 1997, I was working for Reader's Digest, and I and my editors became convinced, as we looked around at the world of terror, that there was a new threat facing America. We began to gather information about a renegade Saudi financier whose name was virtually unknown to most people at this in this room at that time, Osama bin Laden. We learned that bin Laden had a network that spanned the globe. He had operations in the Philippines. He had operations in Europe. Obviously, he had the trading camps and the rest in Afghanistan. And we learned also that he had bank accounts with prominent U.S. financial institutions in London, and that he was getting aid and financial support from top members of the Saudi royal family. Well, in February of 1998, bin Laden issued a fatwa, a religious ruling from Afghanistan, where he decreed that it was a duty upon all civilians or military, whatever they might be. I went to the CIA, asked them to get a copy of that. They said, oh, well, we don't know much about that Fatma Island. To the State Department, they said, hey, that Fatma Bin Laden, and can't really help you very much there. Finally, I located an alert staffer in the Congress, working on one of the congressional committees, who gave me a translated copy. And when I showed it to my editors, we all had our hair on fire, to use a very popular expression these days. Apparently, nobody knew the government did. Well, to make that story short, we finished up the investigation. I was looking for Bin Laden all the way to the gates of the White Mountains in Afghanistan, had a number of encounters which I described in the Creatures of Hate. Published the article with the title, This Man Wants You Dead, in June of 1998, 3 weeks before the twin Arab embassy bombings that cost the lives of over a dozen Americans and 200 Africans. That was the, if you wish, in the public mind, the beginning of the menace of Osama bin Laden. But in fact, as we looked at it, bin Laden had been threatening America and attacking America systematically since late 1992. We found a whole string of events which the U.S. government, the Clinton administration, was trying to deny when we asked them about them. The 1993 World Trade Center bombing, oh no, that's not Bin Laden. Well, no, we don't know anything about Bin Laden in that. Mogadishu bombing, I mean, there's absolutely no evidence that Bin Laden was involved in that. The Saudi bombing in Riyadh in 1995, well, there's certainly no hard evidence that Bin Laden, we're investigating still, and on and on and on. And you saw a pattern of denial by the Clinton administration, a refusal to react. In fact, this prompted what has now become a kind of apocryphal joke among the jihadis. They said, if you hit, this was in the 1990s, if you hit the Americans hard enough, they just might send you a lawyer. When America was struck on 9/11, I think the war on terror hit home for everybody. It also hit home one day. I realized that I knew this network. I listened to these imams. And then it dawned on me. They were saying the same things about us in the West that they've been saying for years about the Jews. And that's when I began to think about doing a book on anti-Semitism, which is what Creatures of Hate is. I wanted Americans of all faiths, and I am not Jewish, I wanted Americans of all faiths to realize that when Jews get attacked in Haifa or Hadera or Jerusalem, Americans are at risk here in Philadelphia, New York, or Chicago. 9/11 taught us that we are at war. But it's not a war that we declared. It was a war that was declared against America by radical Islam. Now, I want to make one thing very, very clear that comes through my book as you read through the chapters that describe some of these radical Islamic clerics that I met as a reporter, whether it's in Gaza or in Egypt or in Jordan or in other countries. This is not a clash of civilizations. This is not Islam against the West. This is not Islam against Judaism. This is a war of aggression by a radical form of Islam that is becoming increasingly the mainstream. I like to say that there is a struggle going on within the soul of Islam. I know Daniel and I have talked about this quite a bit. There's a struggle going on between the preachers of hate and the preachers of peace. I dedicated my book to one of the preachers of hate, one of the preachers of peace, excuse me, Ayatollah Mehdi Rouhani, who's an Iranian dissident. But unfortunately, I've got a report, whether it's in Saudi Arabia, or Jordan, or Egypt, or Saddam Hussein's Iraq, or now in certain parts of Iraq under the U.S. occupation authority. In Iran, of course, the preachers of hate are winning. The preachers of hate are winning. Radical Islam is becoming the mainstream. And it's all about power. It's about intolerance. We are the first liberal tolerant empire in the world's history that hate us for our freedom. So I wanted to go back to the roots, what I thought were the roots of this hatred against Jews and the hatred against the West. And in 1994, I had an encounter which I described in the beginning of Preachers of Hate with Rabbi Abraham Cooper of the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles, for whom I had done some work on
Reconstruction and others. And I was about to go back to the Middle East to do interviews with radical clerics, and I asked him, you know, Dave, what should I ask these people? And he said, Ken, ask them about the protocols of the Elders of Zion. I just sort of listened to that and I said, you got to be nuts. But the leaders of Hamas and these other organizations, they're sophisticated. After I did one, he's a pediatrician. So other people they have PhDs from London universities. They understand that the protocols of the Elders of Zion is this outrageous, fabrication and an anti-Semitic cookbook. They're not going to fall for this kind of nonsense. Ken, he said, just ask a question. So I asked a question. From Damascus to Amman, Jordan, to Gaza, to Jerusalem, to Cairo, and elsewhere, and guess what? Oh yes, the protocols of the Elders of Zion. Here's my copy right here. And I can tell you that you used to have a plot. And I'm going to read you some of the plot. And they translated from their Arabic language versions of the protocols of the Elders of Zion into English and told me how the Jews plan to take over the world through the banking institutions and the sex institutions and the film industry and on and on and on and on. The Jews have been responsible for World War I and even World War II. I said, World War II? Even the Holocaust? Oh yeah, the Holocaust is just a fiction. The Holocaust is just a fiction. So they can create the state of Israel. This is the state of conspiracy thinking in increasingly mainstream parts of the Middle East, and I think we absolutely must listen to what they say and take them seriously. This is not a joke. One of the points I wanted to make to you tonight is precisely about that. When I first came back from this series of interviews in 1994, I did one editorial for the Los Angeles Times, but after that, no other mainstream news organization would take it seriously. They said, well, what's new? We know that they hate Israelis. I said, no. This is not Arabs hating Israelis. This is Muslim clerics who hate Jews. Very different. This is Muslim clerics who say that Jews have no right to exist in the Middle East or anywhere else. Now, I'll give you one quick anecdote. Abdullah bin Ron Tissi, who recently met his maker, I believe he's probably burning tonight with him. I met him in his office in Gaza in 1997, and he said to me, why is it that you Western reporters don't read the protocol? You need to understand the plots of the Jews. There is no room in Palestine, he said, for Arabs and Jews. I said, well, that's not a very hopeful thing. This is Dr. Ron Kissi. What are you suggesting? He said, well, the Jews can go and make Israel in America. We don't need Jews here. Let them go back where they came from. Let them go back to Germany, to Russia, to Ukraine. Americans need to understand that this is what is behind the so-called Arab-Israeli conflict. This is not a conflict about the land, about borders. It's not even a conflict about ideology. It's a conflict about existence. And there is, on the Arab side, an increasingly prevalent belief, and I would say an overwhelmingly majority belief today, that Jews have no right to live in the Middle East. It's not just Hamas, it goes to Arab fashion and all the rest. One of the things I talk about in my book is the rebirth of anti-Semitism in Europe. There's an enabling force in Europe today. I picked three cases of points. I looked at Austria, where you have the typical rebirth of a Jewish community that was decimated during World War II, during the Holocaust. I looked at Norway, a country that has always had few Jews, but in the 1830s, when Norway created its constitution, there were fewer than 2,000 Jews in the country. They already put an article in the constitution that forbade Judaism to outlaw Jews. No Jews around. And in fact, they had their prime minister in 1930 preceded Hitler by about a year in starting to go after the Jewish population, identifying, cataloging, getting identity cards, and getting ready to seize their property. And I also looked at France. France, where I believe anti-Semitism has become virtually institutionalized under President Joshua. The new anti-Semitism, ironically, has gravitated from the far right to the left. I mean, many examples of that in my book is something that shocks the Washington Post, and they discredited my the preachers of hate by saying that I have an anti-left bias. Clearly, they didn't read the book, and they haven't talked to Noam Chomsky, ironically, whose father is a rabbi, but who hates Israel and doesn't believe that Israel has the right to exist. The new anti-Semitism in Europe, the enablers of the new anti-Semitism, hide themselves behind this notion that they are anti-Zionists. In other words, they believe that Israel doesn't have the right to exist. Jews have a right to exist, but not Israel. Well, my question then is, well, if Israel doesn't have a right to exist in the Middle East, aren't you essentially saying the same thing as Abdelaziz Al-Kassi of Hamas, who says, let the Jews go back to where they came from? That's one of the points I make in the book. It's not totally popular with the left, but so be it. Another contrast, I think, is very, very important. Joshua, as president, tolerated 18 months of vicious anti-Semitic attacks in France. Synagogues were burned for the first time since the Middle Ages. I went and interviewed in France the heads of Jewish communities who suffered these atrocities. They told me their stories, and I tell some of their stories in the book. I think it's important to hear them. They would go, for instance, one rabbi told me that in their Jewish school, a man shot out the windshield of a bus carrying school children to the Jewish school. He went to the local police station, wanted to report the crime. And they said, well, what happened? And he told them, he said, well, somebody shot out the windshield. And he said, oh, so you want to report a broken windshield. There's an institutionalization of these anti-Semitic crimes, and it went on for 18 months. And I contrast this to Mitterrand, the socialist president, and I'm a friend of socialist presidents, which you'll find in my second book, The French Betrayal of America, that there's a very different behavior historically. And to be fair, you look at the way that Mitterrand behaved and the way that Chirac behaved, and it's night and day. In 1982, there were anti-Semitic attacks in Carpentras House in southern France, a desecration of the Jewish cemetery. Mitterrand, the socialist president, was there the next day. In October of 2000, when the first synagogue was burned in France, when Chirac was president, he feigned to ignore that the events even took place. And he never once showed up to show his solidarity with the victims over the next 18 months. Not once. Chirac becomes the main character, if you wish, of my next book, which I'll just speak about briefly tonight, The French Betrayal of America. Jacques Chirac is an old friend of Saddam Hussein. He sometimes considers himself as the first Arab president of France. Some of us believe that we may be on the verge of having the first French president of America. The story that I tell in The French Betrayal of America in the beginning is of how Chirac and his foreign minister worked together at the United Nations to undermine the United States, to lie to the United States. Chirac personally picked up the telephone, called up President Bush in fall of 2002 and run up to the war in Iraq and said, Mr. President, we're going to be with you. Don't listen to what I say in public in France. I say all kinds of things for domestic political consumption. I want to tell you man to man, president to president, we're going to be with you. And just to prove it, I'm going to send one of my top generals to Tampa, Florida, the United States Central Command, to work out the details of how we will integrate French troops into a U.S.-led coalition. That's how deeply engaged the French were in our coalition building leading up to the war against Saddam Hussein. And it was just a lie. As I reveal in the book, the French had oil contracts with Saddam worth $100 billion that could only go into effect if they could keep them in power and get the United Nations sanctions lifted. So there's a betrayal, I believe, of a long-standing relationship with the United States, and I tell the story in French Betrayal of America of how close we had been as allies during the Cold War. The French helped us tremendously during the Cold War. They gave us access to one of their
to their top agent, infiltrated at the very summit of the KGB and gave us all the documents. They helped us win the Cold War. So they went from that close relationship to the utter betrayal and the corruption of Jacques Chirac and what happened last year. I'd just like to end with this, and we can open up to questions, and we can talk about some of these subjects, because there's a lot of things that I've thrown out to you here tonight. But I'd just like to tell you this, is that as we go forward, we need to understand that as far as France is concerned, they're not with us in the war against terror. They're not with us in Iraq. And France, under Jacques Chirac, by its actions, has shown that it's no longer the ally that it once was. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ken, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for your very clear and great presentation. Let me start the question by pushing a little bit on the question of the relationship between anti-Semitism and anti-Western sentiment. You said that when an Israeli gets killed in Hadera, we in Philadelphia are less safe. And more broadly, anti-Semitism leads to anti-Westernism. Could you explain the connection, the nexus, most of it?
Thank you, Daniel. I go into that in great detail in the book. Essentially, the Jews are the canaries in the coal mine. Jews get attacked first when there are no other targets around. And what you learn when you start to listen to the preachers of hate and you read their sermons, and besides my own personal interviews with some of the preachers of hate, which I relate in this book, I'm also very much thankful for people like Yigal Carmon and Memory and Palestinian Media Watch of Itamar Marcus, who translates some of this material from Arabic into English. It's terribly important for us to listen to what they say. Anti-Semitism, Jew hatred, is the sewer from which Osama bin Laden and his terrorists have emerged. They learned this with their mother's milk. They learn it in the mosques every week where they go to pray. They learn it from the preachers. They learn it from the newspapers. They learn it in the schools. They're learning it on the airwaves and from the satellite television. There's an anecdote that I tell in Preachers of Hate of a young girl, 3 years old, with this mom who's interviewed on a cable news station that's paid for by a top Saudi billionaire close to the regime in Saudi Arabia. When she's asked her, "What do you think about the Jews?" She said, "Oh yes, of course I hate the Jews." "Well, Mama, why do you hate the Jews?" "There's a story of a Jewish woman in Muhammad." "Oh yes, you know the story of the Jewish woman in Muhammad." And they go back and forth with this anecdote from the Quran where a Jewish woman allegedly poisoned the prophet Muhammad. And this three-year-old girl already knows it. In the Palestinian areas, and I haven't talked about Arafat at all, and he's a big figure in Preachers of Hate. Arafat, whose mentor in life was the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, who was Hitler's acolyte in his voice in Arabic all during World War II, the story I tell as well. Arafat took over the education industry in 1994. Not very many people know that. When he came to Gaza, thanks in part to the United States, one of the things he did immediately was to take over the education industry so he could immediately restore anti-Semitic material from school books with U.S. taxpayer dollars, which blighted. Children in Gaza, children in Egypt, children in Jerusalem, in the West Bank, in Jordan, in Saudi Arabia, in Syria, are being taught from various or very earliest ages to hate Jews and for Jews to hate the freedoms and the tolerance that we share and we hold in common. So we all start from the Jews, Daniel. It never ends with the Jews.
Routinely, when the radical Islam attacks the institutions of the West, the liberal institutions in the West constantly apologize for them, and more frequently than not, they attribute it to the so-called Palestinian grievances against Israel. We have the Inquirer, Washington Post, the New York Times, and so forth, and Catholic universities like Villanova, which is the city of these radical centers. And they shift the focus away from the real hatred of
your question, please.
I'm going to get to what I'm trying to say. Now, today I read that in Saudi Arabia itself.
Your question, please.
Well, that's what I'm going to ask. In Saudi Arabia, they bombed Saudis, which has nothing to do with Israel. Can you please discuss this wall of apology?
Thank you, and you're absolutely right. There is a wall of apology. Let me respond to the narrative. Again, I'm a journalist. I'm somebody who's been there on the ground, talking with these courageous officers, with people on the ground, farmers and shopkeepers in the Palestinian areas and elsewhere. One of the things that has always surprised me is how little in Western media reports on the opposition to Yasser Arafat in the Palestinian areas. Arafat and his the way that he has used anti-Semitism to encourage children to strap vests, explosive vests around their waist and go into cafeterias in the public areas just to murder Jews is not always that popular. There are parents who look at the children and say, I don't want this for my child. But you never read that in the Western media. I recount in the book an anecdote of visiting an Arab farm. It's one of many that I visited. And talking to a farmer who said, can a people back? First of all, he's very reluctant to speak to me. He said, well, you could be an agent of Arafat. He was afraid I was an agent of Arafat because I was a reporter. Because he knew that all Western reporters were working closely with the Palestinian Authority. Finally, he loosened up and understood that he could speak at least guardedly with him. And he said, when you go back, I have just one message for you. Tell the Americans, we don't want to be under Arafat's rule. Here we are. This was a farmer who was in a kind of border area that was about to be adjudicated. He could stay in Israel or he could have gone under Arafat's rule. And it was 50-50. It was a separate discussion. He said, please, whatever you do, don't let us go under Arafat's rule. In Israel, we might not like the Israelis. But at least if we have a problem with the Israelis, we go to court. We hire lawyers. We can deal with it. If we have a problem with Arafat, he throws us in jail. And I tell many stories in the book again of people who have been thrown in jail by Arafat for opposing his authority, and you never see this reported in the Western press. You have people who had extorted enormous amounts of money to get out of jail a year, 13 months, 16 months, and they have to pay $50,000 or $60,000, and this is in a third world country where the average income is less than $1,000. They have to pay $50,000 or $60,000 to get out of jail. This kind of thing happens all the time, and it's never reported in this country. So yes, there is a bias in favor of the rulers in place, the Arab rulers in place, in particular in favor of Arab, there's a pro-Palestinian bias, I believe, in the American media.
Aside from Israel, do we have any other friends in this?
Yes, we do have other friends in the Middle East. I believe that we have great friends in Iraq. And I believe that if we stay the course and if we don't betray those friends, as some people are seeking to do, they will help to create, to expand the territory of freedom and to generate a new form of virus in the Middle East. It will be a virus of freedom that will grow and navigate and go across frontiers from country to country and country to country. Why do you think the Iranian Ayatollahs are so concerned about what is happening in Iraq today that they will commit their treasure and their blood and their people and send people across the border to fight Americans to keep freedom from taking root in Iraq? They know if the Iraqi experiment succeeds, their clerical tyranny in Iran is doomed. We have tremendous allies in the people of Iran, the young people of Iran, who have risen up on many occasions against
modern Tolos. And the United States, in my opinion, and I talk about this in the book, as it's important to understand that the Islamic Republic of Iran has become one of two state sponsors of anti-Semitism, a major state sponsor of terrorism, and a source of anti-American hatred throughout the Middle East. Imagine for an instant a Middle East without the Islamic Republic of Iran. Imagine for an instant a Middle East where you have a democratic regime in Iran, an elected regime, not these fake elections, but real elections, without clerics in power. Imagine how different things would be. There wouldn't be bombings in Argentina at the Jewish center, the Al-Aqsa bombing, with 86 people. There wouldn't be the bombing of U.S. Marine barracks in Beirut, with 241 American Marines dead. There wouldn't be these guerrilla fighters sent across the borders into Iraq to kill U.S. troops and to kill freedom fighters in Iraq. We should identify our allies and know who they are. We should support them and we should stick with them. And we should help them to expand the territory of freedom.
Speaking of change in Iran, I know you've been recently in Libya. Could you tell us about change in Libya?
Libya is a very interesting subject. If you had asked me this question, Daniel, 6 months ago, I would have said, Colonel Gaddafi, change? Never. You ask me today, I say, Colonel Gaddafi, change? He's done it. Let me put it very simply to you. In terms of Colonel Gaddafi and Libya's nuclear weapons program, which, by the way, nobody knew about, Hans Blankenese at the International Atomic Energy Agency, who had been there for years and years and years, never saw a thing. Yes, he never saw a thing in Iraq for all those years. Didn't believe that Libya had a nuclear weapons program. Nobody believed that Libya had a nuclear weapons program. Well, they did. We now own that nuclear weapons program. There's nothing left in Libya of Colonel Gaddafi's nuclear weapons program besides empty buildings. I was in Tripoli on March the 6th when the last shipment of Libya's nuclear weapons gear and its ballistic missiles left. 1,000 tons of equipment on board a U.S. chartered ship. We own the Libyan nuclear weapons program. I'll tell you one other thing when I was there. I sat through an absolutely stunning speech by Gaddafi to his, what he calls the People's National, the National Libyan People's Congress. It's not really a legislature, it's a chilling section. The leadership, and they all believe they're leaders, believe me. They really think they're leaders. Although they don't necessarily impact policy all that much. For 9 minutes, Gaddafi told his own people, don't you fall into the illusion that Libya has been isolated from the world community by the United Nations and the United States. Don't think for an instant that it's the world community that's imposed sanctions on Libya. It's the world community that's hurting Libya. That's not true. It's Libya that's hurting Libya. It's our own policies that have isolated us from the world community. Can you imagine a leader in the West who makes this kind of admission of his own error to his own people, graphically over 90 minutes repeated again and again with example after example after example? We supported the IRA, he said. Well, the IRA is talking to Tony Blair. Should we be more Irish than the IRA? We supported Arafat and the PLO, he said. Well, now Arafat in 93 is welcomed into the south lawn of the White House with the Israeli Prime Minister. Should we be more Palestinian than the Palestinians? This is what Gaddafi told his own people, and it just happened. I was the only American reporter who was there. I don't know, Congressman Kurt Weldon, and Sullivan Reyes of Texas, and Sullivan Martinez, who's in Texas, and Sylvester Reyes, and others. They were stunned after the speech. They had never heard anything like it as well. Obviously, you trust to verify. Trust and verify. We have verified the nuclear weapons program is finished. verify in terms of Gaddafi's support for terrorist groups. He's announced publicly to his own people that this is part of the past, something they want to put behind them. He's also forked out over $2.5 billion to pay the victims of Panhandle 3. Now, as an aside, I happen to believe, I've always believed that Panhandle 3, that was originally involved in Panhandle 3, but there's probably other involvement as well. When I met Colonel Gaddafi, I asked him, you told your people last night that you're going to tell them all the truth, the full truth of what's going on and everything that's happening behind the scenes. Are you going to tell them what really happened with Panhandle 3? Well, I guess the glass knows, and Tripoli hadn't gone quite that far. He wasn't ready to talk about that, but one day maybe we will learn the full truth, and we will learn about the other complicities and the other state actors who were involved along with Libya in that tragedy that killed so many Americans and others.
Can you give us your explanation for why the change?
Yes, this is a tremendous victory for President Bush. There's no other way to put it. Colonel Gaddafi would not have turned around the way he did if it hadn't been for the incredible pressure that the United States government, along with our allies in Britain and other allies in Europe and elsewhere, put on Saddam Hussein. Now, I can put it in three incidents. You can see this. It is so crystal clear when you look at it. Now, I put all this story together on an Insight magazine. We did a cover package on Gaddafi and on the trip, and I have part of this in that story. There are three very, very clear moments. March 2003, Gaddafi contacts, through his emissaries, his officials, U.S. officials and British officials in London, at the very moment that U.S. and British troops crossed the border from Kuwait into Iraq. He sees us going to Iraq and says, uh-oh, I better do something. And he makes the first contact. Now, those contacts go on for several months. And he says, well, you know, we may have had a program, but we're not quite sure that we had a program. And how much do you know about a program that we might have had? It's kind of carrying back and forth. So far, he's not quite very clear about what he wants to do. He's feeling his hand. Second moment, October. The United States, with allies in Malaysia and in Italy, managed to force a freighter, a cargo ship, loaded with centrifuge components for a nuclear enrichment program. By the way, this is the Afro-Qatar-Khan network that had shown that you were by this freighter. We forced this freighter, we intercepted it and forced it to ground in Italy. And what I've been told by U.S. officials and others, that freighter contained the mother load of their nuclear enrichment, their uranium enrichment program, and that seizure, we did incredible damage. He couldn't recover easily from that seizure. From that moment on, he began to talk more openly to us. And all of a sudden, instead of this parrying and this bantering back and forth, well, how much do you know that we got this or that or the rest? He said, okay, yes, we were trying to enrich uranium, you're right. Yes, we had a centrifuge enrichment program, you're right. Yes, we had a ballistic missile program, you're right. And yes, we were doing this and that and the other thing. And all of a sudden, the exchange between Libya and the United States and Britain became much, much more detailed. And he allowed intelligence officials from our countries to go into Libya. And the final phase occurred in December. Gaddafi's, right, this was told me by some of Gaddafi's aides. Gaddafi is watching the cable news networks, and he gets cable news through satellite in Libya as Saddam Hussein is pulled out of this fighter. And as it was described to me, he watches a U.S. medic in those latex gloves, picking the lice out of Saddam's hair and poking to his guns, and Gaddafi turned white. There, by the grace of Allah, go I guess. Within a week, he issued his statement, the famous statement, December 19, 2003, where he totally abandons his nuclear weapons program, acknowledges responsibility for Panhandle 3, agrees to pay compensation to the victims, and essentially gives in to all of our demands. And over the next couple of months, U.S. officials, British officials, intelligence officials, and others were going back and forth. They opened all of the doors in Libya to our people. We were crawling through the country. We were crawling through the country. And that's how our incumbents concluded that today we now own the Libyan weapons program. There is nothing left in Libya. And simply put, Gaddafi realized he was in his own best interest to get rid of it. That's why he did it. We bribed him. We didn't offer him anything. We showed him by our behavior in Iraq what would happen to him if he continued in that mode, and he understood what was in his best interest.
Could you please explain what happened with the UNWRA in resettling all the refugees in the world after the Second World War, but they failed to resettle the Arabs that were displaced in the Palestinian area? And why, the two-part question, and why, seeing that we recognize Arafat as a terrorist and PLO as a terrorist, why are we giving them $1 billion?
Well, for you, just laid out on what may be the subject of my new story. UNRWA is the subject. UNRWA is the organization of the United Nations that has been funding Palestinian terrorist camps for 50 years with our taxpayer dollars. I've been to UNRWA camps. I've been to Lebanon, I've been to Syria and to Jordan. And the PLO and all of its branches, all of its composites, its component organizations, they all have recruiting stations. They do, in Lebanon before the 1982 war, they were using UN schools in Beirut to train kids in anti-aircraft, to manipulate anti-aircraft guns and to do gun training, to clean their rifles in courtyards of the schools. And they've been doing this for 50 years, and that's been clear. UNRWA ought to be abolished. It ought to be abolished. The Arab nations won't allow us to do it. And I've yet to see a U.S. president who has put that at the top of his agenda. Now, to be fair, to get that to the top of the agenda, there's a lot of other things you've got to do first. But UNRWA is clearly an organization, part of the United Nations, that funds terrorism, that encourages irredentism. It encourages Palestinians to remain refugees instead of getting a life. One quick story, in 87, one of my trips to Israel, the Israelis were trying to build up something called the Village Leagues, a local Palestinian civil defense authority, so they could take care of their own towns and villages and civil defense authorities, police and fire and the rest. Well, those people were considered collaborators by UNRWA and by the PLO representatives in the territories, and they assassinate them one by one. The Israelis tried to build housing in the 80s to get Palestinians out of the camps. Palestinians refused to move. Why? Because UNRWA and the PLO assassinated, in the same way that you saw in South Africa with the Nexus Brigade, they assassinated people who agreed to do that, or who tried to convince other Palestinians to move out of the camps. It is an absolutely criminal, in my opinion, it is criminal behavior on the part of the United Nations to enforce upon two generations of Palestinians this refugee lifestyle when 50 years ago they could have gotten a life, they could have moved on, they could have had land, they could have had patrimony, they could have had their own country. And it's frankly the UN system and their supporters who prevent that from happening.
Two quick observations. One, it might be hard to get the United Nations to close down UNRWA, but the U.S. government could easily stop sending $120 million a year to it. That's slow down the issue. And the second would be that what is distinctive about UNRWA is that whereas all other refugees in the world are refugees only themselves, not their children, in the case of Palestinians, it is children, grandchildren, at this point, great-grandchildren. It is a status that continues and grows and festers. So it is actually the definition that is particularly malicious and tasty.
If Israel is removed from the equation of the Middle East, what changes or how are the dynamics of the Middle East evolve?
That's a frightening question. And it's one that gives great joy to all of the the so-called Arab Israel issue is not about Israel. Israel is seen as the forward, as the leading edge of Western colonial occupation of Arab land. Once they get rid of Israel, then they come and get rid of us. One of the stories I tell in Breaches of Faith is a meeting of Umar Bakri Muhammad, who's a radical cleric of the head of Abu Jahrun in London. And he likes to say that Islam will become the state religion in Britain. He talks about an Islamic Republic of Britain. He talks about Islamic republics throughout Europe. Osama bin Laden has talked about Al-Andalus, which is the lost Muslim territory of the Iberian Peninsula, which they lost when? 1492. Israel is a sideshow for radical Islam on the march. But make no mistake about it. If they need Israel, they will need us.
How do you think events will play out under the new situation where Bush denied repatriation of the Palestinians to their lands and also acknowledged that after the Israelis had the right to some settlements on the West Bank? How do you think that will play out? Because that is a big change in the climate of the United States.
I applaud the President for what he did. I applaud the President for having finally recognized that Jews have the right to live in historic territories, whether it be the West Bank, Judea, Samaria, or wherever. I think it's a very important thing for him to have done. Why is it certain? Why is it that Arabs have the right to live in Israel with all the full rights of citizenship and voting rights and protections and civil liberties, but Jews cannot live in, quote, Palestine?
Thank you. What do you make of the two scenarios? One, the fact that Jordan already is a Palestinian state. Do you think that will ever get any traction? Also, this other plan where there is going to be one state, a joint so-called Israeli-Palestinian state. Will either of those pick up any traction as far as you're concerned?
This is politics and traditions. I don't think so. The quick answer, the Jordanian monarchy, the Hashemite monarchy, has always defended itself from being taken over by its Palestinian majority. That's clear. I don't see that changing in the near future, but, you know, change happens. As for the idea of a single unitary state in what used to be the League of Nations mandate and the British mandate of Palestine, this is what the PLO has asked for all along, because they know that they have a majority in terms of population, and so they have hidden behind this sort of neo-Stalinist left-wing idea of democracy. One man and one vote, and so they believe that if there is a unitary state that encompasses Gaza, the West Bank, and what is today Israel and its current borders, they are absolutely convinced that they will take it over and it will be theirs. And bit by bit, they will kick out the Jews. This is part of Arafat's, the PLO's phase plan. I attended that, and by the way, the fact that Preachers of Hate, it's important for people to read it, is what they believe. And finally, Husseini, who was a major Palestinian leader before his death a few years ago, gave an interview where he talked about the Oslo Peace Accords being a Trojan horse. And he said, a Trojan horse, he said he needed to get a physical presence in Palestine so we could bit by bit, gradually, piece by piece, gain more territory, and ultimately consume Israel. I believe that remains the goal. I believe that remains the goal of Arafat, of the PLO, and until they abandon that goal, and until the Arab world finally recognizes that we lost the war of 1948, the creation of Israel, we will not have peace.
Thank you. There's evidence of thousands of Iranians being involved in Iran. GR is being killed there because of these assaults. Why is the administration, why have they been reluctant to unleash the bullets from Iran?
Why have they been reluctant
to unleash
our full power against Iran is at the border sites where they're infiltrating Iraq.
I think this is a very delicate situation, and the Iranians so far are playing as they like to play, in the shadows, behind the scenes. They're infiltrating people where it's not terribly obvious. They haven't moved troops. You know, they have brought intelligence agents and Revolutionary Guards officers and guardsmen in guise of pilgrims to religious shrines where they will not be recognized. They have been funding Muqtada Sadr, Muqtada Sadr being the Yemeni firebrand cleric who's holed up in Najaf. He, by the way, it is not terribly well known, he happens to be a nephew of the so-called moderates president of Iran, Ayatollah Muhammad Khatami, and they get together very frequently. So, by the way, it's a myth that there is a group of moderate clerics in Iran that we ought to be supporting and everything would be all right. I believe it's also a fallacy. Why don't we take off the gloves and deal with them? In my opinion, and from what I see and talking to people at the Pentagon and the White House and elsewhere, we do this a battle of the tongue. And the president has given full authority to his commanders in the field to determine how they will deal with it. And he's not going to second guess him here in Washington. And I am certainly not going to do that as a journalist.
Could I ask you on the question of France, why you see this turn by the French from being our close ally to betraying us? Surely the Iraq connection is not the only thing, especially now we're posted on the Iraq.
Well, there are a number of things involved, and I look at the biography of Jacques Chirac, the president of France. It's very important to understand who this man is, how he began politically. He's a creature of Saddam Hussein. He gets his start with money from Arab leaders. He creates a political party overnight when he's in political disgrace, and that party becomes a national party. Nobody knows where the money comes from. You have to look at Dominique de Villepin as well, the foreign minister, who's now the interior minister. And I have a little phrase that I quote from one of Villepin's books. The book is a 200-page romantic look at French politics and where France should be in the future, called The Gargoyle's Scream. And there's a wonderful little phrase in there. He says, "Not a day goes by that I don't smell the perfume of the discreet violet." French foreign minister. What he means by that, the discreet violet is a symbol of loyalty to Napoleon. Villepin and Chirac believe that France cannot accommodate itself to the 21st century unless they return to the glories of Napoleon. And I always wanted to ask you, Brian, that I had the occasion, or the hopes of asking, what is it that you really admire about Napoleon? The fact that he sacrificed the lives of 400,000 young French from the plains of Moscow in a vain attempt to overthrow the Russians? Or is it really just Napoleonic cult? He venerates Napoleon. Villepin says France is afraid of the future, France is afraid of the 21st century. France looks at America and understands it cannot compete. France needs to go back to its glory days, and the glory days are days of an authoritarian government. A government that people respect just because it is. I think it's very troubling. Very, very troubling. A prominent U.S. senator who visited me not too long ago told me this anecdote, which I also talked about it in the French Affair of America. He went to go see Villepin's office in Paris. And Villepin immediately launches into this tirade and says, "You know, the problem with you Americans is that you don't read Machiavelli. Of course we lied to you at the United Nations." I tell the story of those lies, of course. "Of course we lied to you at the United Nations. Of course we lied to you about Iraq." That's what the big boys do when they play politics.
Time for one more.
Do you think, though, with America, we're such a tremendous power, you know, militarily, economically, that if the Arab world, Palestinians, Egypt, Jordan, Saudis, if we created more of a where, you know, our wages and still maybe more economics for these people live and have jobs and did well and have prosperity in some way, and try to do that using different strategies would create a much stabler, better buildings, because when people have, they're much more comfortable, and they, and, you know, during, I mean, the Clinton administration, just when they were just negotiating and talking, there wasn't the intifada, there wasn't, the violence that's going on right now, because there was talk. And right now there's no talk, and it's just, I don't know if you feel that. I mean, if there was more of an economic, better situation, you have things, people won't hate as much. You never mentioned anything about the economic situation.
No, I don't mention anything about the economic situation because I recognize that with some of the modern, it comes from one of the wealthiest families in Saudi Arabia. I recognize that most of the Al-Qaeda recruits come from well-to-do families. These are people with jobs, with educations, with futures. Many of the suicide bombers in Gaza and the West Bank are people with children. Mothers have given their children and encouraged them to commit to carry out these suicide bombings. This has nothing to do with economics. It has to do with hate. Now, as far as creating jobs and improving the situation, the economic situation of people in the Middle East, in other words, why don't we just make nice? Well, why haven't the Saudis just made nice for the past month? The Saudis have had several $1 trillion of oil revenue. What have they done with that money? Well, a portion of it has gone to build the palaces of the kings, not just in Saudi Arabia, but in the south of France, in Marbella, in Spain, and elsewhere. Prince Bomber has got his place in Aspen, Colorado, over I don't know how many hundreds of acres, and on and on and on. Why don't the Saudis spend part of their treasure helping people to get jobs instead of fostering hate? You know, there's higher unemployment today in Saudi Arabia than there was 20 years ago. The standard of living is lower today than it was 20 years ago. And the imams in Saudi mosques preach more hate today than they did 20 years ago. Why don't the Saudis spend their treasure trying to change the world of Islam, which is their world, it's not our world? Why don't they try to change their world from the culture of peace? But what the Saudis do is breed the culture of hate and of violence. So I think really we should turn this question around and we should ask the Arab regimes to do their part before you start asking the U.S. taxpayer to right the wrongs of a corrupt ruling class.
Let me just note as well that there was an erroneous assumption here that the violence did not begin while the talks were taking place. The violence began in September 2000 when the talks were very much taking place. So that doesn't hold that presumption. But let me, it's 7 o'clock, let me thank Kenneth Timmerman and all of you for taking part in this most interesting exchange. Thank you, Ken. Take advantage of the sales of the books, Creatures of Hate, the French Betrayal across America. These are important books, and I look forward to joining us at the next Bizarre Lecture at the Middle East Forum.